told you this.
Came home exactly, and she was in tears. And I tell you the story right now. I'm in tears.
Really, right now.
It was something. Well, that something was strange.
And that was. It's strange that you're weeping right now. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, that is your first major healing as a healer, a teacher, or something, right?
Yeah.
Now, what? I was thinking, had you read Krishnamurti? Were you reading the Krishnamurti while you were running this Portland Center?
Yes. Yeah. The First and Last Freedom was published, and I got a copy of that book. And when I read that, it was like a bomb going off. Atomic bomb. It just blasted everything I believed in. It just shredded all my ideas on spirituality completely. And it was, but it was healthy. I knew it was healthy.
Yeah, you knew that it was towards enlightenment.
Yeah.
Even though
and
it not...
if anybody was enlightened, it was Krishnamurti, I thought.
Even though he denied all the enlightenment ideas.
Yeah.
So you were pretty good at understanding that.
Yeah, you see, if you talk, communicate, you have, like we're doing now, you have to talk in ideas, right?
Yeah.
There's no other way. So, you know the limitation. A rose is not a rose, The word is not the rose.
Right.
The color is not the rose. The smell is not the rose. But what the rose is, you will never know. You can't talk about it. If you talk about it, then you're creating an illusion. You're creating a description of that rose, which is based on the previous descriptions you have of roses. And all the knowledge that people have of roses is there in our bank of memory. So I was getting that, but it comes in degrees of realization. It doesn't come all at once. I would suspect that words, ideas were a limitation, were not the thing. I Wally and I talked about a lot about that, and I got that from him. In fact, he said if I should read Krishnamurti, he said he's the only guy that's got it right.
And that was said before the books were dropped on you, the papers.
Around that time, yeah.
Like he didn't know you got the papers.
No. But then I told him all about Krishnamurti. He went, yeah. Yeah.
And Krishnamurti was not available in America at that point in person.
Hmm.
Krishnamurti was not available in person at that point.
Yeah, he was not in America at the time. He also had been ill, and he had been staying in Europe and India. Now, I don't know about India, but he was staying in Europe. But if he was in Ojai, nobody knew about it. So, and I only knew in 1960 that the first talk was to be given. And he was still ill at that time, even in 1960.
Well, he was 60. If he's born in 1895, he was 65 in 1960.
Yeah, but he looked great. He looked great, even though he was ill.
Yeah, those pictures when he's younger, he's very handsome.
Yeah, he was very, Indians are handsome people, so.
Yeah. So we're going to talk, the Krishnamurti throws doubt into your channeling experience. And I think you say in your book that even before you go to Seattle, when you start closing down the Portland Center, you are moving away from being a guru.
Yeah.
Talk about the problems of being a guru, what the psychological nagging or the itch, the irritation that occurred to you. You didn't like the separation of yourself from people.
Well, it's mostly about being false. False. You falsify
you didn't think
yourself.
You were you? Mm-hmm. You didn't think you were being false when you were channeling?
What I thought was that does this really help anyone? That was my question. Are people
right?
They would say yes, of course I'm helped. They would say they wanted me to continue, you know. And they were getting satisfied. They were getting bits and pieces of information and having insights and experiences and so forth. And they wanted to continue that. That's what we do. But I was beginning to see, does this really help them? Now, you know, Krishnamurti talked about, people ask him, do the masters exist? Clarify this once and for all, you know. In other words, earlier in his life, he claimed that the masters taught him. They initiated him step by step into the state, and the masters were there when he was enlightened in Ojai and et cetera and all that. And then later he dropped talking about the masters completely. So then people said, well, what about the masters? You know, do they exist? And his answers were very, he never gave an honest answer, I felt. Even when I read him, I thought he's not giving the honest answer to this. He may have his reasons for it, and I can speculate what those reasons are. But when you invest your belief in another, you falsify yourself, is the basic premise to this problem. So when you have a guru, you falsify your own worth, because you are the guru. You are the source of your own enlightenment. You are the source of your own intelligence, not the other. He may stimulate you. He may say the door is over the yonder, over there. You have to go through it. You have to walk, get up, go. But you have to do it. So that hit me with Krishnamurti. He was saying, you have to do it. It's up to you. Don't put your faith in another. Don't put your faith in me. Don't worship the vessel, the outside vessel. It's what's inside you have is what is the reality, is the source of your experience and understanding. And even today, now, I question all my experiences. I question if there is such a thing called understanding, even. Because I say, I understand. I understand what? I say, I understand. What does that mean? So, going back to Krishnamurti, he implanted that idea, question this outward authority, the authority in another. You have to do it. So when I was doing the channeling, people were coming, listening to the information, putting their faith and their belief and their attention in this manifestation, into the guru, and is that going to really help them, was my question. And of course, this was my problem. It was my problem. And I was also being a guru at the same time. People were saying, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? Can you help me? Blah, blah, blah. And I, you know, said, well, try this, do this, blah, blah. Or I would say, that person's a false, a fake, a phony. Don't listen to it. Or read this book, or don't read that book. I was giving some instruction, some help. I was giving talks twice a week, trying to help people understand that they don't need someone to tell them what to do. But it's a game. It's a game. They need you, and you need them. You need them because they support you. They need you because you support them. You give support to their ideas, to their beliefs, to their wants, to their dreams, etc. So this was irritating me for some time. And anyone who professed to be a guru, I would question, you know, why? What is this business? Okay, there's somebody who knows a little more than the other. He's a little smarter. He's a little more clever. He has had some experiences, perhaps, that made him feel that he's different. And he may be different. Okay. But to put that person on a platform and to worship that person, I thought was false. Even when I met this Swami Ram Dass, not the Alpert, Dr. Alpert Ram Dass, but right. The real Swami Ram Dass from South India, when I met him in Seattle, Washington, he said, "Don't worship Ram Dass. You worship only the God in you." Well, he put it in the Indian terms. Today, I wouldn't say the word God. I'd say you don't need to worship anybody, anything.
Right. So
one
the...
has to put their energy into freeing themselves from the crutches that we have created, that gurus have made. Religion is a crutch, you know. And the gurus are selling the crutches. That's all.
Right. Now, your mother passes in early 1950. Yeah. You spend a year or so reading this Enlightenment literature. Then you start channeling. But within, maybe 53, 54, within 3 years, you've got the slam from Krishnamurti. You're very young getting this.
Yeah, well, okay. I everything came to me young. I was there first. I was a kind of a Renaissance person, we'll say. I've been described as a Renaissance man, okay? Yeah, I got interested in all these things, you know. Why? Why is a person this way? Why? What makes us tick, you know? And I was suspect of all the answers that were given.
You were looking for the gap. See, your magicianal youth really put an idea in.
But that was the razor's edge. That gave me the freedom.
Yes, it gave you the detachment of whatever was happening around you. You almost considered existence a magical trick that you were inside of.
Yeah, in fact, when I was listening to Krishnamurti and San in Switzerland in 1966, I kept saying, what's the trick? Just give me the trick. What's the trick? There must be a trick to it, you know. I called him the trickster.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's before the term was popular.
Yeah.
Before
Bob Dylan. Yeah.
Right. Oh, did Bob Dylan create the word trickster or make it popular?
I don't think so. But his song "Mr. Tambourine Man" was he was talking about the trickster.
Yeah. Okay, so but you know to have these abilities, and I want to ask you in a minute about them, but to have these abilities and have people put you up on a pedestal in your own in your 20s, that's pretty early. And then to have Krishnamurti make you question it, that puts you in a real stress that none of the other people, I guess, had around you. Nobody was taking in Krishnamurti and yet being a guru. Nobody had that conflict that you know of, right?
Well, maybe here or there. I don't know.
No, I mean in that period in Portland.
Yeah, no, nobody really knew about Krishnamurti, except the theosophists, and most of them were, there was a split in the Theosophical Society. Some in Ojai, California, were followers of Krishnamurti, and they split from the mainstream theosophy. There were those Krishnamurti followers, we'll call them. And then there's the old-time theosophist who said, "Oh, he has forsaken us, we bet on the wrong horse." You know, so forth.
Yeah,
and
so the Krishnamurti faction, the Theosophists, said, "Follow your own way." They would spread Krishnamurti's message, but they were still duped by Krishnamurti.
Yeah, well,
or still hypnotized by him. Okay.
Yeah,
I want to ask you. Go ahead.
Well, I visited a woman in Pasadena, California, 1955, I think. She was the head of the Ananda Ashram in outside in Pasadena. And she was a follower of one of the Vedanta Swamis who had broken away from the Ramakrishna mission and formed his own separate organization. He didn't follow the Calcutta mat or organization. And I thought she's an interesting lady. When Swami Ramdas from India was traveling around in California, he visited her, and I knew about that, so I wanted to talk to her about Ramdas and what she felt about him, because I was questioning what happened to Ramdas. He had something. There was an energy about him, a lightness and a tremendous energy. He could talk for hours and was never tired, and he was in his 70s, and he was sweet and loving, and you could feel all these vibrations, you know, of love from him. You know, I was intoxicated. I went around for 3 days in a state of bliss in Seattle after seeing him. And so I wanted to say, what the hell is going on with this Ramdas? And I was in conflict because of Krishnamurti.
Yeah.
So when I did meet her, she said, oh, these people have the power to hypnotize you. So I said, yeah, I think you're right. We are under hypnosis, you know. Self-induced, probably. But
yeah.
So Krishnamurti, Jiddu Krishnamurti, in his own way, was creating an image that he was the guru. Even though he said, there are no gurus, you know, or don't follow the gurus, they're charlatans, they're frauds. And only in very subtle terms did he acknowledge, yeah, I'm a bit of a guru myself, I guess, you know.
but he was original in the sense that coming out of the Indian cultural enlightenment genre of literature and the oral tradition of that, he was original by saying, well, that's all crap. So that he became a guru of that new idea. And top of that, he had Western people supporting him, saying he was the mafia.
Yeah. I think what...
I'm not
what,
the mafia, the messiah.
Yeah,
they
mafia.
Say the messiah.
Same thing. Anyway,
yeah.
No. The thing is this, is that if you put your faith in a system of ideas, whether it's Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, or what, if you put your faith in that system and you follow those procedures, yeah, something will happen to you. You'll have experiences. If you're a Buddhist, you'll see the Buddha. If you're a Christian, you'll see Jesus. If you're a Jew, you'll see Moses. So on. And that does give you an edge to your personality and so forth. But it is not it. It's not it. It's still secondhand. It's the experience that somebody else has had that you're experiencing because of a system of ideas. So you're experiencing mental images, mental experiences that are part of the psyche, part of the general mind stuff that we're all made of. So Krishnamurti was saying, yeah, you can follow these things, but they're not it. So don't follow them. Don't waste your time. But he said, maybe if you're lucky and the door is slightly ajar, the evening breeze will come in of itself, by itself, and you will be engulfed in that bliss. Okay, that's another carrot. That's another hope. Maybe, somehow, the door will be open. You know? I won't open it, but maybe it got left open. Hope is there. So, I questioned this with Krishnamurti. I kept saying, yeah, he's saying maybe, giving me hope. So I lived in hope. When's it going to happen? How can I open the door? You know, how do I surrender? You know, it was my question, you know.
Did you confront him about that?
Yeah. Change the subject.
Clever
clever guy.
when you were in Rishi Valley that you it got
yeah,
to that
I changed
point.
The subject. Subject changed the subject.
Okay, when you look back at your channeling, psychologically, or what is your theory of why you were channeling, or what was going on there? If were you subject to some psychic hypnotism or hypnosis? Like, how would you explain?
I think there is a vast reservoir of knowledge that exists. It's made of all the human experiences that mankind has ever known, and also all the other levels of consciousness are part of it. You know, all of it's the essence of the living life. It's a residue, still vibrating, still has an existence. Nothing dies, nothing ends, nothing, you know, everything is eternal. There's no such thing as death. Life is infinite. No such thing as an ending. So I think you can slip into that state of becoming conscious of that strata, of subconscious strata in our own being, where all that information is, all those experiences exist. Certainly when you take a psychedelic, that forces the door open. And you have no choice. Suddenly the gates are thrown open and all this rushes out. All these variety of experiences and states of mind. So I had that psychic inclination to easily lose myself. I was not a strong personality at one part of my nature. I was a timid person, a shy person. I was a hurt person in my childhood. And it was easy for me to, if I saw something on the stage, an actor in a movie, I could become that actor so easily. I could imitate that actor so without any effort. So it was so easy for me to slip out of my own sense of personality. And I slipped into this sea of information, which has a personality. It has everything in it. The Buddha is there. Jesus is there. Krishna is there. All is there. Krishnamurti now is there. And all the entities are there. So
right. So is this Jung's collective unconscious?
Yeah. Would be another way of talking about it.
So is it culture and thought, or is it only in this dimension, or is it in the other dimensions you go to if you assume you survive death?
I don't think there's any separation.
Yeah.
At all. What we call the survival of death is, you know, is a viewpoint that I don't want to die. I want to survive. But what's there when this body does come to an end? What's left is just the memories. And they vibrate. They exist. Just like the television set or the radio is playing, all that information is going out into the universe. It's going on and on and on, and it will vibrate forever. Just as we're talking right now, this is going to exist forever. So, I don't see any difference between what people call the after-death experience and the collective unconscious. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So that if you are conscious after you die, you will think of the experiences you get in that plane as memories.
Yeah.
And
so
then
who you're talking to, if you're talking to a medium, with a medium, or some mediumship is involved, is you're talking to memories.
Did you, in your channeling, answer questions about Atlantis, Lemuria, and those kind of historical questions?
A little bit. Not much. Didn't dwell on those much.
Yeah, people would bring it up, but you probably didn't have any strong repository of information on that.
not an interest in it, but a little bit. But it was all, you know, certainly there was, we human beings didn't spring into intelligence, 5,000 years ago, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened 30,000 years ago? What was happening? There was intelligence. People were doing things.
So is Edgar
this,
Cayce...
This is our present culture and technological science we have today can all come to an end if there's a catastrophe, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we'd lose all that science. So certainly there could have been an Atlantis. Yeah, why not?
So do you think Edgar Cayce was a better kind of medium, or he just was a sensitive kid and opened himself up to his own memories and the culture? Is there a difference in the sensitivities of people?
There's no difference between his own memories and that reservoir. See? My point is, you are not separate from that storehouse of information. It's part of you. What makes you talk is that.
Yeah.
What makes you ask questions is that. It's asking the question.
Yes. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Everything
I agree. Now
I say, everything I think, everything I know, everything is part of that past. And it is past wanting to be permanent. And so uses you, your human body, as a means to make itself permanent.
Right. Are we hearing right now what Robert Carr said in 54, 55 in Portland?
No.
This is a later wisdom, or a later version, a later criticism.
Yeah.
And when could you say what you're saying now? After you met U.G. Krishnamurti, probably.
Yeah.
He pushed you into this level of, quote, detachment, disillusion, hopelessness, and energy. And energy. Know what I say? Energy.
When you're not there, then that energy is there. It's you who are using that energy as an escape from your ideas about where you think you shouldn't be.
Wait, say it again. Which energy are we talking about, pure energy or the energy of the unconscious?
There's just one energy. That's all there is.
Okay, state that sentence again.
It manifests itself. That energy is manifesting itself in all the myriad forms of life's experience. You know, everything. They're just that energy.
And then you said the energy was something avoiding what you thought you could hope for.
Okay.
Did you?
Okay, that energy has everything in it. The good, the bad, the beautiful. Using the movie term. No, it has everything.
Yeah.
It has all the aspirations, all the wants, all the degradation, all the filth, all the beauty. From the top to the bottom, it is everything. It's the evil. It's the good. All these things are there. So that energy has a desire to be free from the burden of its knowledge. So it thinks about being free and uses you as a means to be free of that burden. It's all just a tremendous, you know, configuration of life's experiences. Everything is there.
It's a loop, a Mobius loop.
Just endless. It keeps expanding itself. It wants more and more and more. Only a rare individual says, enough, God, enough is enough. I can't take it anymore. and jumps out.
Yeah, you were saying that.
I knew that back in 1954. I knew that there's a way out of it, you know.
So, okay. Now we're going to move towards the psychedelics, but before that, you leave Portland on the success of your career. Portland becomes too small town. You want to expand to a bigger place in Seattle, and the opportunities surface, you continue your channeling in Seattle, right?
Yes.
And what is that, 55, 56? We know Worcester shows up at the end of 56. How long had you had the center before Worcester showed up? 2 years?
54,
right. Yeah. So you had the center for about 3 years in Portland, and then 54, 55, you're in Seattle. And you got this, and you're coming to Seattle with a more leaning toward the Krishnamurti side to the degree you'd understood him.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And you don't really want to be a guru in Seattle, or do you do it a bit? You do it a bit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I still continue, yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't have gone to Seattle and had the economic support if you weren't pretending to be a channeler.
Right.
And so that was good. You get up there. What do you want to say about this transition period? What stories or people come up? I mean, Wally dies in that transition, which is interesting. You know, he was such a big influence in Portland, and then he's gone when you go to Seattle.
Yeah.
You caused it. You abandoned him. He felt lonely. He went nuts. He didn't have a student anymore.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that for sure. I felt sad when Wally died and perplexed. But I sort of understood him, you know, that he was just fed up. You know, just, he couldn't take it anymore. The frustration was so great, you know. And that renegade nature just took over, you know.
You know, when I read your book about Portland, and I think about what we're talking about, the early 50s, I keep thinking of Blue Velvet, David Lynch movies. Like, this whole world of the early 50s is like a David Lynch atmosphere. And do you know what I mean? You know his movies?
Yeah.
You know, like what, Blue Velvet, Eraserhead, what was that one?
Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, but that's more L.A. That's later in your life, so to speak. But thinking of the small town, yeah, it's Blue Velvet, where it's a small town, and there's this underground culture represented by Dennis Hopper, who turns out to be a drug dealer, and the cops are involved with him. And you go to Dean Stockwell's place, and he sings this funny song, or sings the Roy Orbison song, beautiful song, with these fat women in the background. This whole small town oppression or repression or something going on with the id running around at night. That sounds like, to me, especially the 50s kind of.
Yeah, that's kind of a way of putting it. That's very true. Portland was a very small town in its own way, and I was a small town guy.
And you had these weird people in the Bohemian building.
Yeah, all these artists. And so there was another fellow I met there from San Francisco. He was Brian. I saw him in that Bob Dylan film, Don't Look Back. He was with Bob Dylan in one of the shots. And
really?
I recognized him. Yeah. He had been he was a painter. And I used to hang out at his studio, and I didn't really buy what he was saying. He was flirting with communism, and I thought, communism, just another ism, you know.
Yeah.
So.
You don't mean Bobby Neuwirth, the
no,
main
his name was Brian.
Hanger on.
No, his name was Brian. He played the banjo.
He might have been in the London scenes.
Yeah, I think it's the London scene, yeah.
Yeah, because Donovan is there, and people are playing with Dylan, and, you know, just people off the street, so he probably was there. That's the footage I remember.
Yeah.
So, anyways, Brian was another person you hung out with in Portland a little bit.
Who? Oh, a little
Brian.
Bit.
Brian.
Not much. I only saw him a few times, and that was enough.
He was dealing with the external political world, which you as a timid, right. The timid side of yourself would steer away from.
Yeah, I was the inner world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say, well, the inner world's important, not the outer.
Yeah. Now you aren't so sure.
No, I don't see any difference.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you get up to Seattle. And who is the transition person there? Who's helping you there? Is it Phyllis?
Phyllis Goodall. She was a good friend and helped me and stabilized me. And Grace Chapman was the one who funded my coming to Seattle. She bought a house and said she would give it to me as a center. And that was a mistake on my part. And anyway, I didn't last very long, and shortly after that, I shifted to a bigger house on Broadway Street, and Phyllis Goodall, helped me, you know, put that together and so forth. Listen, Bob, I'm gonna have to call it, quits now.
Okay, no, that's good. No, we covered the first phase.
And we can start with, we can start with Seattle, then. We can start with the more of the center activities and go into it.
And that's the Broadway address. That's where Dave Worster ends up in late 56.
Right.
Okay. Well, it says in my timer an hour and 44 minutes. There's Dave Worster's number 144. It's a good time to stop.
Okay. I enjoyed it very much. So tomorrow?
Tomorrow night, same time, 11 a.m. your time. It'll be your Tuesday.
Okay, fine.
No, it'll be your... Wait a minute. It's
7 o'clock my time.
Yes, and would that be Monday or Tuesday?
It'll be Today Tuesday. Tuesday.
Yeah, your Tuesday. Okay, we got it.
Yeah.
All
okay.
right, we'll talk tomorrow.
Ciao. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, Scott.
Bye, David.